From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, memories of a massacre in Syria. The economic development threatening old Istanbul. And the Mexican musicians, famous internationally, unknown in Mexico. We've just passed the 30th anniversary of the Hama massacre, when Syrian troops crushed an anti-government uprising by the Muslim Brotherhood. It's thought that between 10 and 40,000 people died in the city of Hama, in one of the most shocking acts of collective punishment in modern history. For three decades, no one in Syria ever talked of the events, but now the people of Hama are rising up again. NPR's Kelly McEvers reports.
For 30 years, most Syrians didn't even talk about Hama. The walls have ears, they would say, even in the privacy of their own homes. If we talk about what happened in Hama, they might come for us and kill us too. Now, that's changing. Abu Basil was 14 years old on the night of February 2nd, 1982. It was almost dawn by the time he heard the first gunshots. Militants from the Muslim Brotherhood in a neighborhood not far from his were fighting government troops. The government responded in full force. Abu Basil heard explosions, the whizzing of rockets. He saw helicopters landing in the city's main stadium. Snipers positioned themselves on rooftops, phone lines were cut, soldiers went from house to house, interrogating men and taking them away. Abu Basil's schoolmate was taken to a nearby university and beaten and tortured for 3 days. Abu Basil's uncle, Abu Abdu, was hauled out of his house with six other men in broad daylight. Abu Abdu says one soldier felt sorry for him because he was short and thin, so he let him go. Later, when Abu Abdu came back outside, the six men who'd been hauled out with him were dead in the street, and dogs were feeding on their corpses. Abu Basil's little brother fell ill, so they took him to the hospital. The hospital turned them away. The family passed the hospital morgue on the way out the door. Abu Basil says he saw the bodies of more than 30 men who were dressed like simple farmers, discarded and left in a pile. The detentions and killings lasted a month. Abu Basil's family fled Hama for several weeks. When they came back, Abu Basil saw that large swaths of the city had been flattened. Abu Basil stayed in Hama, where for years he worked as a criminal lawyer. When Syrians began rising up against the government last spring, Abu Basil says he was with the protesters in spirit, but not in body. Until recently, Abu Basil has been part of the so-called silent majority in Syria. The millions of people who've stayed at home while protests rage in the street and the government violently cracks down. But just last week, government security forces were attacking Abu Basil's neighborhood in Hama when a bullet ripped through his kitchen where his wife had been standing just minutes before. That's when Abu Basil decided it was time for him, his wife, and four kids to leave Syria, come here to northern Lebanon, and start talking. This regime is a facade, Abu Basil says. Now that we've broken our wall of fear, there's no turning back. A few hours' drive from Abu Basil in the notorious Shatila slum in Lebanon's capital, Beirut, a kind of Syrian wives' club has assembled around little cups of bitter black coffee. They joke about how, after two uprisings, there are no men left to marry in Hama. Abdullah was 6 years old when the massacre started. Two of her cousins and her uncles were taken away. Her cousins were jailed for 13 years. Her uncles never came home again. We never talked about this, says Noor, who's also from Hama but recently fled to Lebanon. Now that the regime is killing and detaining our men again, you can't shut us up. We're on our rooftops, shouting, yelling, banging pots and pans, whatever we have. Now we say whatever we want. For perhaps the first time ever, ceremonies in cities around the world will publicly commemorate the Hama massacre in the coming days. Inside Syria, protesters have vowed to take to the streets in great numbers, but security forces have put Hama on lockdown. When I asked Abu Basel why it's only now that the wall of fear has been broken, he turned his eyes to the sky and thanked the young Tunisian man who set himself on fire more than a year ago and sparked the uprisings that have swept the Arab world. Shukran, Bouazizi, Abu Basel said to the heavens. Thank you, Bouazizi. Thank you, Tunisia. Kelly McEvers, NPR News, Beirut.
Coming up, the economic development threatening old Istanbul, and the Mexican musicians, famous internationally but unknown in Mexico. We've all heard stories about the economic woes of Greece, but the economy of its neighbour, Turkey, is booming. The largest city, Istanbul, is awash in new luxury hotels, villas and fancy restaurants, with more upscale development in the works. And that's brought a different kind of woe to the city's working-class neighbourhoods and to some of its most beloved open spaces. NPR's Peter Kenyon has this story from Istanbul.
On a frigid January morning, bundled-up travellers step off a ferry and scurry toward the imposing stone walls of the Haydar Pasha train station, the 19th-century landmark that was once a major stop on the Berlin to Baghdad line. Several dozen of the people boarding the Bashkent Express this morning are in a nostalgic mood. They're longtime Haydar Pasha employees taking one of the last runs to Eskişehir, where the station's first director general is buried. They're going, as it were, to give him the bad news, that Haydar Pasha's 150-year service as a public transportation center may be coming to an end. Officially, the station is closing temporarily for repairs and the laying of high-speed track, but employees fear that during the two-year closure, the decision will be made to convert the station to a more lucrative purpose. Plans are still under discussion, but possibilities include a luxury hotel, perhaps with a museum, and a shopping mall. The potential closing of this iconic station is just one of the fast-moving major projects alarming urban planners and local activists. Working-class neighborhoods with names like Ayazma and Tarla Basha have been cleared of their inhabitants to make way for villas and hotels. Public schools and hospitals, some in historic buildings, are being sold to private developers. And a third Bosphorus bridge is planned, bringing roads and developments to a large swath of forest land in the city's northern reaches. It's all part of what Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan has called the drive to push Istanbul into the top rank of global cities.
With the new convention centers, sports and cultural centers that we're building, we're preparing the way for a modern future on an historic foundation. At the same time, we're investing to turn Istanbul into the financial center of the world.
That comment from the Prime Minister is included in a new documentary on the impact of growth on Istanbul. It's called Ecumenopolis, a term coined in the 1960s to suggest a future in which sprawling metropolises merge into one giant urban dystopia. Director Imre Azem says in the course of making the film, he learned that back in 1980, urban planners agreed that the city's geography could support a maximum population of 5 million. With a current population estimate of 13 to 14 million and a forecast that it will hit 25 to 30 million by 2023, Azem says the municipality should be much more concerned than it seems to be. He's also distressed by a trend that began well before Erdogan came to power, but has been embraced by him, the transformation of open and public spaces in the city into profit-generating commercial properties. One example is occurring in Istanbul's main Taksim Square, part of which has been a park since the early 1940s.
So we're in the middle of a park in Taksim Square. What, and you're looking at a red cross on a tree. What does this mark signify?
This mark signifies that this tree will be cut down. There are many actually marked with a red
mark.
Yeah, all of these actually. This is because this park will be turned into a shopping mall.
Until early in World War II, an Ottoman military barracks stood here. The historic building fell into disuse and was demolished to create Taksim Park. Azim says developers have long coveted this prime property, but were blocked by laws protecting the city's green spaces. Then they hit on the idea, he says, of using Turkey's laws on preserving historic buildings.
In order to protect this already demolished building, they're rebuilding it. They're saying they're preserving it, but it's already gone. They're making a restoration of the old barracks, like an imitation, which will serve as a shopping mall.
At a nearby restaurant, the head of a neighborhood citizens group is desperate to raise public awareness of the changes in the offing. Nazla Enlioğlu recalls that during the earthquake of 1999, Taksim Park was the only safe place she could sleep. Even if the city leaves a bit of the park in the courtyard of the rebuilt barracks, she says, it will no longer be a safe haven.
I think absolutely not, because if they build the barracks, then there will also be a building surrounding the park. And the purpose of going to the park was that there were no big buildings around it anyway.
Back when he was mayor of Istanbul, Erdogan took a strong stand on the project activists today fear most, the Third Bridge. In 1995, Mayor Erdogan was quoted as saying a third Bosphorus bridge would be a crime against the city. As prime minister, though, Erdogan has embraced the bridge, as well as new car and train tunnels. What infuriates critics of the Third Bridge is what they call its transparently false rationale. It's supposed to relieve Istanbul's heavy traffic congestion, says activist Cihan Baysal, but its proposed location is much too far north to affect current traffic flows.
We just can't believe it, really, because that part of the city is where we have all the green, the forests, the ecological reserves, water basins of the city are there, actually. I mean, when you build the bridge, immediately you build the roads, you cut down the trees, all kinds of neighborhoods coming up.
Here's how this stretch of the Bosphorus, close to the Black Sea, is described in the city's best-known guidebook, Strolling Through Istanbul.
Now, for the first time on the Bosphorus, one finds sandy beaches hidden away in romantic coves. Gray herons haunt the cliffs. Great clouds of shearwaters, those lost souls of the Bosphorus, skim the surface, torn by frequent schools of dolphins. The scene is much the same as when Jason and his Argonauts sailed past on their way to Chalcis in search of the Golden Fleece.
Several groups have sprung up in opposition to the various projects to transform parts of the city, but they're hampered by disparate goals and small numbers. Supporters of the projects say they'll improve living standards and create jobs. But activists say Istanbul residents could one day wake up in a modern segregated city, with the rich locked in gated communities and the poor in high-rise public housing blocks, which critics say is a recipe for unrest, crime, and a host of other problems megacities around the world are struggling with. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Istanbul.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. A Mexican guitar duo has developed an avid following in the US and Europe. The duo, Rodrigo y Gabriela, have even had their music featured on the soundtracks of major Hollywood movies. But the pair is practically unknown in their native Mexico. Now, with a new album, they're hoping to raise their profile in their home country. NPR's Jason Bobian reports from Mexico City.
It's a Monday night at an old movie theater that's been renovated into a nightclub in the heart of Mexico City. Rodrigo y Gabriela are on stage with their signature nylon string acoustic guitars. Rodrigo Sanchez and Gabriela Quintero are natives of Mexico City. They started playing music together here as teenagers in a heavy metal band in the 1990s. But more than a decade ago, they went off to Europe to play in the streets. It was in Europe that they developed into Rodrigo y Gabriela, an acoustic guitar act that hit the top of the Irish music charts in 2006 and has sold more than a million albums worldwide. But they've been gone from Mexico for so long that on stage here, Rodrigo lightheartedly plays the role of a foreigner in a foreign land.
En México, bueno, venimos el año pasado, pero no es un lugar que acostumbremos venir, aunque está muy bonito.
This is not a place we're used to coming, he says. Then he adds wryly of what used to be his hometown. It's very pretty. Rodrigo y Gabriela have performed all over the world. They've sold out the Radio City Music Hall in New York. Last fall, they played the Hollywood Bowl, backed by the Los Angeles Philharmonic. They've been on Jay Leno and MTV. But in 2010, when they were invited to the White House for a state visit by Mexican President Felipe Calderón, Calderón appeared to have no idea who they were. On stage in Mexico City, with just two guitars, Rodrigo y Gabriela produce intricate arrangements that draw from a wide range of musical styles. Gabriela provides the percussion and what at times can be furious rhythms banged out on the strings and body of her guitar. Rodrigo's fingers fly up and down the frets, plucking out riffs and melodies. The physically grueling intensity of their playing took its toll in 2010, when under doctor's orders they had to cancel much of their U.S. tour. They often get slotted into the world music genre, but Rodrigo says categories are something they try to avoid.
We come from a rock background, from a heavy metal background. We don't play heavy metal, but we don't play Latin straight music or Mexican music.
Rodrigo calls what they do acoustic rock, with a few extra twists thrown in. Gabby Gomez, who books the El Plaza Condesa, where Rodrigo y Gabriela are playing on this night, says it's unusual to have a rock act that's just two acoustic guitars. Until just recently, she says, Rodrigo y Gabriela weren't getting any airplay on Mexican radio, and Gomez says she first heard about them in the foreign press.
At least to me, it was funny to see a Mexican, well, Spanish name all over, you know, Rodrigo y Gabriela, which was kind of... I don't know, it was surprising to see that they were Mexican. Like, where are they from that we just didn't know about them?
And to add to their confusing cultural identity, Rodrigo y Gabriela's new album, Area 52, was recorded in Havana with a full Cuban orchestra. Gabriela says the Cuban project made sense for various reasons. Their record label was pressuring them to come up with a new album. They both grew up listening to Cuban music, but they'd never been to the island.
When I remember said to Rock, we need to go to Cuba, man. We need to go to Cuba and go there as a musical experience. One day. And that day, we just passed by, you know. But for us to be in this room with all these musicians, it was just incredible. We were like in heaven, you know.
Her only regret is that they were working constantly and didn't get to see much of the country. Gabriela says they did manage to go out for dinner once in Havana for her birthday.
And we got mojitos and all, but that was it. Just one night.
It was pretty full on, and it was like 12 hours in the studio, you know? It was crazy.
Their musical success abroad has allowed them to buy a house in Zihuatanejo on Mexico's Pacific coast, northwest of Acapulco. But that same success also has meant that they don't spend much time there. On February 19th, Rodrigo y Gabriela kick off a four-month tour to promote their new album. Along with a Cuban orchestra, they're scheduled to play concerts across Europe, the United States, and Canada, but not Mexico. Jason Beaubien, NPR News, Mexico City.
International coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.